Welcome to episode 6 of Soundography, your crash course in popular music, one band at a time. My name is Brian Ibbett.
And I am Hammond Chamberlain.
And this week, we are diving into the metalist of heaviness and the heaviest of metalness, a band called Iron Maiden. Boy, this is... I'm going to just go out at the beginning of the show here on record and say, I'm not your typical heavy metal fan, or I'm not a heavy metal fan, really. This is why I wanted to cover it first, because I think it lays the groundwork, it lays the foundation. When I was younger, when heavy metal was first coming into popularity in the late 70s and early 80s, and all through the 80s, really, there was stuff I was a fan of, kind of the classic heavy metal stuff, but I never resonated with any of the newer hair metal bands and just straightforward rock heavy metal bands. They never really connected with me, with a few exceptions. And what's cool is developing an appreciation for heavy metal over time in the 90s and especially in the 2000s and today. I can see get beyond the screaming and the guitars and the drums and everything, the syncopation and or lack of syncopation sometimes, and get past that and recognize the technical prowess and talent that a lot of the bands that were huge, a lot of heavy metal bands that were huge in the 80s and 90s have. And I can appreciate that for sure. And I think we're going to hear that come through with Iron Maiden, but you know, for a guy who my heavy metal library consists of some Poison, some Motley Crue, a little bit of Black Sabbath, a little bit of Metallica, some Guns N' Roses, and this stuff is like you said, hey, what are some of the ingredients that make up a heavy metal band? Okay, let's put them all into Iron Maiden.
Well, and I'm going to be honest. I am very picky about my Iron Maiden.
Sure.
There are three albums that I refer to as the pinnacle of Iron Maiden.
I bet I can guess which ones they are, too.
And I'm sure we'll get there.
Sure.
And my Iron Maiden experience is very much focused around those three albums. Uh-huh. And this, for me, was an experiment in starting. I started at Iron Maiden and listened straight through.
Wow.
And I watched two of the movies. I read a book.
Holy cow, you did your homework for this one.
Yeah, I dove headlong into this. And when I came out the other side, I felt a little bit like Andy Dufresne.
Yeah, I'm sure you did. Did you raise your hands in a victory salute up at the sky as the rain came falling down on your face, smelling
of rancid Eddie?
Right, really smelling of Eddie. Yeah.
Well, it's funny because I have to admit, the last album, their most recent album, was actually a breath of fresh air after hearing.
Really?
Yeah, I really
the brand new one. Or yeah, the newest
book,
one.
Yeah, Book of Souls. I was really glad that it kind of shifted from some of that, well, Iron Maiden stereotype. Mm-hmm. And we'll dive more into it, but it's going to be a long time before I put on any Iron Maiden again.
Even part of your Holy Trinity.
Yeah, the Trinity is even taking a hiatus.
You've got a wrapper. Actually, you've got some chains on it with a sign that says, do not open until Christmas
2020
even. Wow. All right.
But I mean, but it was fun. That's the one thing I can't say about this is coming off of some of these other ones, there are some definite things I noticed that I wouldn't have noticed if we weren't doing this show. And there are some things that I enjoyed more and things I enjoyed less because we were doing the show. I was looking at it with a different set of ears and a different set of eyes.
For sure. Yeah. If you if you were to look at our trajectory over the past three or four episodes, right, and looking at Pearl Jam and then kind of steering off into more pop and blues with Blues Traveler, and then kind of delving downwards into folk a little bit and then steering back over a little bit into pop and power pop with the Bay City Rollers, it's almost like the gas pedal got stuck as we were rounding the Bay City Rollers corner and launched us into Iron Maiden. I mean, there's strings that you can kind of connect between those first four bands, but from Bay City Rollers to Iron Maiden, you're actually looking at a wormhole.
You're not looking at next week. Yeah. Next week.
Next week. Yeah, no kidding. Actually, Iron Maiden, right. Iron Maiden is the wormhole, and we're zipping back over. We'll talk about next week at the end of the show. But so these guys have been around for a long time, and they're one of the legends of British heavy metal.
Yeah, the new wave of British heavy metal that really kind of launched the sound and this flavor and the style forward. And all the bands that came out, all the thrash bands of the early 80s, they listened to these guys and they imprinted on them. And it was, you know, Def Leppard and Diamond Head and Witchfinder General and, you know, Trauma and all these bands that were kind of this embryonic stage of punk and pop meet, you know, distortion pedals and some talent, because there has to be some talent to play heavy metal. I don't care what people say, to be able to play technically and fast, you have to have some talent behind it.
Definitely some talent. We'll get to where the other shoe is going to drop. But let's talk about the history of the band. So in 1975, they're formed in East London in a town called Leighton by Steve Harris, the bassist.
This is not our first band formed by a bassist either.
No, quite a few of them. And you listed a few of them here, like Duran Duran, Motley Crue, who we haven't done a show on. But
it seems to be a common thing is a bass player wants a band, and so he builds a band.
Right, because you can't... Here's the thing. If you're a guitarist, you can kind of go out on your own. Like if you're like a rhythm or even a melody guitarist, I guess the lead guitarist kind of thing, you can kind of go out on your own and do some music, maybe pull in a session drummer and do that. If you're a bassist, you kind of do need some supporting musicians.
Yeah, there are a few solo bass players out there.
Right, right. I can't think of one.
Well, I think that Victor Wooten would be considered... have the ability to be a solo bass player.
I know. Mark King from Level 42 put out a solo album, but I can't imagine what that would have sounded like if it didn't have any session musicians on there.
Yeah. There are people out there who probably could, but I think that as far as just a bass on tape, nothing else, right, there's very few people that could pull it off.
Yeah, for sure. So he formed the band and, like you said, on Christmas Day in 1975.
Ironically enough. It's like, Merry Christmas, here's a bass guitar, and here's a band.
Right. So he was a former member of the band Smiler, and had Doug Sampson on drums, Dave Murray on guitars, and then a vocalist, a guy named Paul Di'Anno, and added them 3 years later. They released a four-song demo, recorded a four-song demo, distributed around to club owners, and Ron Smallwood, who would become their manager, said, hey, this is great. Let's release it. They recorded, I think, 5,000 or printed 5,000 copies of it. It sold out in 1979. They called it the Soundhouse Tapes. And that kind of was their launching point, you know, getting discovered by that, by Ron Smallwood and kind of helping launch that beginning of their career.
Yeah. And there's been lots of changes since then as far as lineup and things. But as far as what they started out as a root, there's been evolution, but the Soundhouse Tapes still sound like Iron Maiden of today. I mean, that's the thing that's really interesting is the fact we're 75, 80 when that stuff was going on.
Wow.
And we've evolved technologically and, mm-hmm. you know, all kinds of things. And the band has changed and aged. And you play them side by side, and yeah, they sound a little younger and spryer and a little angrier, because we've talked about that before with, you know, bands first starting.
Sure.
But it's still Iron Maiden.
For sure. Yeah, and is there, this is something that's come up among my friends talking about music as not really a debate, but is there a better path? So, for example, let's look at Iron Maiden, right? A solid, consistent sound. They are, for lack of a better term, kind of like McDonald's. You go to a McDonald's anywhere, and the burger you get is going to taste just like the burger you get at any other McDonald's. And yeah. So you know what to expect. And I think that's one of the reasons McDonald's is as popular as it is. And you look at other bands like...
AC/DC.
AC/DC, Rob, the Violent Femmes.
Rob Zombie.
Rob Zombie, right.
Typo Negative does it.
Green Day. I mean, basically every... You know, their album has a very consistent sound.
I can't say that Green Day did break off, because I think American Idiot does not sound like any of the other things they've done. Yeah.
Okay. All right. I'll withdraw, Your Honor. you look at these bands, and there's a very consistent, I don't want to use the term predictable in a negative sense, but it is a, you know what you're going to get. And yes. If you like this, then you're going to like the next thing. Chances are you're going to like the next thing. Then on the other side of the coin, you've got bands like, all right, Green Day, but more drastic examples would be like U2, mm-hmm. Madonna, and these reinventions, maybe not every album, but certainly... Every so often, frequent. I mean, there's, U2 has gone through so many different cycles of sounds.
Well, Metallica has done it.
Metallica is another great example.
I mean, even Blues Traveler has done it in small ways. I mean, we've talked about it with the people we've discussed so far. Duran Duran does it.
Right. Oh, Duran Duran's another good example. So what is there, does it depend on the band as far as whether it's the right path? Let's say you're a band and you've released a couple albums and you've definitely identified your sound. Do you try and do something wildly different, or try and reinvent yourself? And reinvent yourself for a reason that's not, oh my God, our last album tanked. We need to do something, because U2 arguably has not had that problem. They haven't had to say, oh my God, if we don't do something, guys, hey Bono, if we don't change our ways, we're not going to be.
If you don't change the kind of sunglasses you're wearing, we're done.
Exactly. So you're a band and you've released a couple albums, you've defined your sound. Your third album, do you decide to, hey, this is working for us, let's not change it? Or, hey, let's try and change things up and let's do a concept album about a serial killer named Mike and involve a flute.
I think it depends on how your fan base is, because I think it has less to do with the band than their fan base. I think that Iron Maiden could do divergent albums and do different things, but because their fans expect Eddie on the cover and a certain sound,
right?
This is what they do, and there's proof in that, because in 95 and 98 when they did the X Factor and Virtual 11. That didn't match those the formula exactly right. They didn't do as well. Mm-hmm. But then you have bands like Spock's Beard and Dream Theater and Mushroomhead and even Megadeth to an extent, where they do kind of push things around and challenge the fan base, and the fan base can kind of accept it.
Right. Yeah, totally. Yeah, I guess it depends on the band itself and the fan base.
Yeah, the relationship between the two. And Iron Maiden has definitely developed a relationship with their fan base in as intimate as a way as a band can with as millions and millions of fans as they have.
For sure. Yeah. And if there's any other evidence, it's the fact that number one, Eddie appears on every single cover, just about every cover. And number two, their logo has not changed since the very beginning.
No, this is the kind of consistency that makes other bands just nuts, because they don't miss.
Right.
It's the same stuff. And we mentioned a little bit before we started recording that the one thing that kind of I learned through this experience, this marathon, mm-hmm. was their sound has evolved very little. And I really wish that they'd used a broader spectrum of the equalizer.
Sure.
And not just live so much in the mid-range. Because when they record live shows, the bass drums and the bass are low and the guitars are high and Bruce Dickinson's right there featured in the middle and it kind of surrounds you and it's big and you can kind of feel it. On almost every album, all of it's crammed into the mid-range spectrum and it kind of really gets annoying after a while.
It turns into static, like it turns into white noise if you're not paying attention. I found that as I was listening to these albums, that actually was happening where I'd be listening. Maybe I'd be doing something else. I'd be doing some work or have something going on. But for the most part, I was there to listen to the music and rate these songs and kind of figure out where my top five were. And there were times I'm like, oh, I completely missed that last song. Let me mm-hmm. play it again. And I play it again. And I drift off again. It's like, oh, I missed that song again. I guess that's not going to be in my top five.
Well, because when the vocals, the guitar solos, the bass, and the rhythm guitars are all within a narrow band of mid-range EQ, it gets all just, it turns into something in the background.
For sure. One of their trademarks, though, that I always that stuck out to me as I was going through this, and I wanted to make a note of it because it is the one thing that I feel does separate them from a lot of other bands is this trademark of the dual lead guitars, and I'm guessing that that's Adrian Smith and Dave Murray.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And doing this, you hear it most prominently, or like if you're looking for it to say what do you mean, if you listen to the beginning of The Trooper, it's the first thing you hear is this harmony guitar, two equally leveled guitars playing in harmony. I really, really like that. And I think that if you were to play a song without any Bruce Dickinson vocals, but that had that in it, I'd be able to identify that it was Iron Maiden.
What's really interesting is in that Hearing Aid, the heavy metal fundraiser for African Relief that they did, they had the two of them play together on the solo. They didn't give them each their own.
Oh, really?
They had them play together. Cool. Yeah.
Wow. So you've got to really be tight in with the person you're soloing with to be able to do a solo, really not even a solo, to do a guitar solo with somebody else that you don't veer off into different directions and cacophony. Wow.
So let's just do Iron Maiden by the numbers real quick before we get into the discography, which could take a while.
Yeah.
They had 38 albums, 16 of them are studio, 11 live, 4 EPs, and 7 compilations. Now, I can tell you, I did not listen to the compilations and I did not listen to the EPs, but I did hit almost all of the live and all of the studio.
Wow. Okay.
I missed like 2 of the live.
I listened to a majority of the studio albums. I stopped at about 92. I take that back because I did go past 92 and listen to some of the newer stuff. Didn't listen to any live stuff except for live tracks that were included on the one compilation that I listened to, which was the, Moment in Time, Best of 1980 mm-hmm. to 1990, I think mm-hmm. it's called.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Which is a really, you know, as much as we try to stay away from greatest hits albums, that is a really solid greatest hits album. Oh, yeah. Album.
And in their live stuff, they do something that I really, they can write a song that involves a live audience like no other band. They are so good at building the whoas and all the things, the chanty things that crowds can do while you sing, they have at least one of those in every album. And it's genius.
That's great.
Because they know they're going to play it live. They know the crowd's going to want to get involved.
I saw a Queen tribute band a couple weeks ago. I sent you some photos from Red Rocks when we saw it. And every single song, and they played for an hour and a half, almost 2 hours. Every song had some sort of audience interaction component, and sometimes it was repetitive. It was like, all right, everybody jump up and down, and or let me put your hands up in the air for We Will Rock You. They want our hands up in the air the entire time. And I went with my Uncle George, who is the biggest Queen fan I know. And also, there's no other band that George knows more about than Queen. And George is a huge music guy. So, you know, walls of vinyl albums and CDs and music. And there's no band that he knows better than Queen. He's seen them in concert, you know, when they came through Denver, which they didn't tour through America a lot. And when they did, they very rarely hit Denver, but he saw them when they came through. And I asked him, I said, all right, this has to be just, you know, this killer Queen tribute band doing this. He says, no, this was something that Queen would do, is they would involve the audience every time. And I said, my gosh, I feel like I'm doing calisthenics here. I feel like I'm in Queen boot camp.
Yeah, Queen Catholic Church.
Right, exactly. But that felt like not pandering, but kind of saying, we need a way to get the audience involved. We want to make sure that they're engaged the entire time. And it felt like a cheap way of doing it. Whereas the live stuff that I did here from Iron Maiden, where they did that, did not feel like it was shoehorned into a popular song. That it was, nope, we're doing this because the band or the fans love this song. We want to engage them with this song.
But they've included the fans in helping pick track listings for best of albums. They've included let the fans name their airplane.
Right.
Wow. I mean, they've really done what they can to bring the fans in. But you know, and the thing is, it pays off because this is a band that's been together since releasing albums since 1980. In 2010. The Final Frontier peaked at number one in 28 countries.
Wow.
That's kind of nuts.
It's unheard of, yeah. No kidding.
They're considered one of the most important and influential hard rock bands, heavy metal bands in history. Most of the bands I listened to in high school and through college and even now either make reference to them as influences, acknowledge them in songs. Like we did Blues Traveler. Psycho Joe is on my playlist. Psycho Joe mentions Iron Maiden.
Oh, really? I didn't catch that. That's great.
The name, I guess, was inspired by the movie The Man in the Iron Mask and the Iron Maiden, and they kind of put it together, the torture device.
Totally makes sense.
Which makes the joke of Bill and Ted's, put them in the Iron Maiden. Excellent.
Right. Oh, yeah, right, right.
Yeah, yep. There's all that. But they played 2,000 plus live shows over the course of their career, and they sold 90 million records. Now, for a band that technically plays a niche style of music, that's kind of nuts.
For sure.
So when you start looking at the things that they've accomplished with the, now we've acknowledged the sameness from album to album, it says something about whatever chord they strike.
Exactly. And the fact that they did find that audience, you know, and they play to that audience. And I think there's something great about that. I think that's something admirable for a band to say, you know what, we found our core, we found our sound, we've got a dedicated set of followers, we're not going to do something that is going to kind of pull the rug out from under them, we're going to deliver the same thing that made them love us in the first place, and we're going to keep delivering it. And I think there's something very, very admirable about that.
They're in the book Running Free, which is about the first 10 years of Iron Maiden. There's a quote, and I actually wanted to read it. It says, they have always had a glorious individuality. You could never mistake a Maiden tune for any other band's. No one before or since has ever come up with a cranium-kicking cocktail quite like their maddening mix of hyper-energy, muscle melodies, killer clout, twin guitar harmonies, and historical harmonies. Somehow they've managed to combine being intelligent and musical with a noise and a chilling aggression.
Very true.
And it sums them up.
It totally does. Hits the nail on the head, because here's where I had the problem with Iron Maiden, and also where I came to really appreciate Iron Maiden. you're making a pizza. I don't know why I keep bringing up food references like McDonald's, and maybe I'm really hungry, but all right, you're making a pizza, right? You've got your dough. You got some really, really good dough. You've got your sauce. It's fantastic. You can put some, you know, your mozzarella on there. You put your pepperoni, mushrooms, whatever. I'm not going to tell you what to have on pizza, but I'm, you know, you're making your straightforward. When you think of the word pizza, this is the thing that falls into your mind. Not your jalapeno peanut butter pizza, or, and that is a thing, by the way, it's really good, or your anchovies, or your pepperoni, or your pineapple and Canadian bacon Hawaiian pizza. But you're straight ahead. When you think of the word pizza, boom, these are the ingredients in front of you, and this is exactly pizza. But there's not, while that pizza is solid and good and delicious, there is not that uniqueness that says this pizza is better than any other pizza I've had, or this pizza is something special over another pizza that's got those same ingredients, with the one exception of those dual lead guitars. I think that that is the spice that's added to this pizza that says, all right, here's something unique about this pizza. And it is, you know, they are a solid, talented band. Bruce Dickinson's great. The guitarists are great. The drumming is fantastic, especially when you get some solo drumming. You get, there was a song on, one of the albums, and I'm never going to remember it. I want to say it was Power Slave, that begins with some sort of jungle drum kind of thing that continues through. Continues through the whole song. Really, really like that. And it is solid. It is technically talented. It is flawless. And if it weren't for that spice of the dual harmony guitars and occasionally the Bruce Dickinson hooks, I probably would have slept through the whole
discography. And see, this is the thing that's interesting. That I love the twin guitars. I think Bruce Dickinson's voice is one of the best voices in metal. It's right up there with Rob Halford. It's as distinctive. It's powerful. But what's really interesting is the way they write songs, because the basis of the song, you're right, is that standard pizza. But what they write about sometimes is what actually pulls you in. They tell stories. They give history lessons. And like, you know what? Like crazy history lessons, not just minor ones like, hey, there was a war. But they go into the evolution of cities.
Right. Oh, yeah, totally. Or, you know, the plight of the Native Americans and things like that. I will, you know what, another thing I'm going to give you on this is the fact that that Bruce Dickinson's vocals, not just talented, and I'd probably put him up there. I wouldn't put him at the top of my list. I think Axl Rose, for as much as I like and dislike Guns N' Roses, but anyway, I mean, I'd put him up there maybe in the top 10, but there are a few other vocalists that I think have a little bit more definition for me, or that I make more of a connection with. But his vocals, crystal clear. Like, you don't have to have a lyric sheet to understand what he's saying when he's singing. You can pick all that up from listening to the vocals. And that's something to be said for somebody who can do the heavy metal screaming thing. Who can do the heavy metal screaming thing, but still have it clear enough that you can pick out the vocals and pick out exactly what they're saying. And I think Bruce Dickinson does that really, really well.
And he has sung on all but four of their albums, the first two and the two with X's in the title.
Tell me that that's purely coincidental, the X's.
I think it has to be coincidental, but that's the way I remembered it.
That's great. I love that. So 95 is the X Factor and 98's Virtual 11.
Yeah.
Which is written as Virtual XI, which is that 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That's not their 11th album though. That's their 10th studio album. Maybe there's something else in there that,
it might've been Alive. They counted.
Right. Right.
They might've counted.
Or the Soundhouse tapes or something
that. They might've, I think probably they counted the Soundhouse tapes, I bet.
Yep. Because you wouldn't want to put a number in a title of an album unless it was that number album. But But boy, yeah, when you do get to Peace of Mind, that first Bruce Dickinson album, and especially when you get to, I'm going to predict that your three, when you get to Number of the Beast, which was the first Bruce Dickinson album, when you get to that one, Peace of Mind, and I'm going to guess that your Holy Trinity right there is number, well, are they sequential?
Yes, they are sequential.
Okay, then I'm going to say Peace of Mind, Power Slave, and Somewhere in Time.
You're off by one.
And Seventh Son of the Seventh Son has to be one of the three, right? So Power Slave, Somewhere in Time, and Seventh Son. I loved Seventh Son of the Seventh Son.
I think that is a fantastic album.
It is. And if it weren't for that album, I would have had a really hard time getting through this. But that came at the right time. The bummer is that it isn't on Apple Music. I had to go to Spotify for it. But I'm glad I did because, man, that's some great stuff. I've got a couple tracks from that on my top five list.
Yeah, it was hard because I could have picked my top five totally from those three albums.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see why.
And I decided I'd stretch my wings a little bit because there's a lot of other things in their history that I like, but yeah. Mm-hmm. So,
and nothing, you know what? And that's not to say that there's anything wrong with No Prayer for the Dying, because I feel like that's another good solid album.
Yeah. I was knee deep in college and didn't have the time to really sit and listen to that one as I did the other three, which I was in high school for. Mm-hmm. But I graduated from high school in 88 and then started college, and my music listening really trickled off. And so I had to spend time on things that I had to make time. Mm-hmm. And I just didn't make time for Maiden, which is the name of my 80s sitcom.
Making Time for Maiden, starring Nell Carter, Mr. Belvedere. So here's another really cool thing about Iron Maiden that I really like and really appreciate is the fact that they are not just a band, or they're not just saying, hey, we're going to put out album after album. Here's album. Here's another album. These are great. Enjoy these albums. They branch into all these other things, and video games, not one, but two, at least two video games. The box set here that I'm holding in my hand called Iron Maiden Ed Hunter, which is it's kind of a greatest hits album.
This is the one the fans pick the track listing for.
How can they not? Oh, there it is. Okay, it's on CD too. I was going to say, how can you do an Iron Maiden fan favorite album and not have Run to the Hills? But it is the first song on the second album, or the second CD. But then the third CD is a Windows 98 game called Ed Hunter, and I'm guessing what, first person?
Yeah, it's a first person shooter. Very much in the style of like Resident Evil, where they throw things at you and you shoot the thing they threw, and then you have to shoot the person that threw it. And it's got moments. I think the best part's the soundtrack that, you know, plays Maiden tunes while you play through it.
Right. But the newer game, and it's funny
because came out this year.
It didn't just come out this year, but it came out at least when I was told about it was the very same day Pokemon Go came out. Was it out before the beginning of July?
I don't remember. I downloaded it the same day I downloaded Pokemon Go. And what's weird is Pokemon Go is now gone, and I'm still playing Iron Maiden.
Really? See, there you go. There's a testament. And it is a fun RPG, 3-on-3 kind of battle game, kind of like your Avengers Alliance, your Star Wars battle, or not Battlegrounds, but Star Wars Commander. I can't remember what the Star Wars game is like.
It's like Final Fantasy meets Iron Maiden.
Yes, right.
Early Final Fantasy, not the pretty one, but the other one.
And they just basically have this perfect mascot in Eddie. You know, I mean, the fact that Eddie is, he'll come out on stage during their tours. It's some dude in a humongous, you know, Eddie costume, or even like a...
robots.
A rope, right. Or not marionette, but basically something that is kind of controlled from up above. Mm-hmm. Hard to describe it as a marionette because I feel like the two are so far apart. But and this mascot that you see on their albums and everything, and it is, it basically helps this band transcend beyond just being album rock.
I think that the two of us could get two artists on and do an entire episode of any show just talking about the artistic stylings throughout the albums too. That's a whole separate show.
Oh, sure. Yeah, no kidding.
And I can tell you that Iron Maiden knows how to do a box set. I learned that through this thing. They have done box sets where they compile their singles and rare B-sides that you can't find anywhere else, and they stick them in a box, a metal box, and sell it. Mm-hmm. They did this thing called Ed's Head, and it's all of the albums to that point in a plastic, vacuum-formed, glowing eyes LED head of
Iron. Really? Of,
yeah, if you go on eBay right now and look, it's probably selling for $800, $1,000.
Wow. Okay.
They did the Ed's Archive, which is a bunch of B-sides and live things inside of a metal, a fancy metal box.
Oh, that's cool. It looks like a chest, like a little necromancer chest. That's mm-hmm. the thing too, is definitely have an occult flair to them.
Mm-hmm.
I know they get accused early on of being satanic, and that was a whole big thing. And obviously there's, you can kind of see why.
Oh, yeah.
The outside viewer would say, oh, yeah, they're totally satanic. Rawr, keep away, kids. But more so than Black Sabbath, more certainly more so than, you know, Metallica or any of those other bands, Motley Crue, things like that, these guys had that flavor, that that kind of demon flavor to their stuff.
But what's weird is there's also a sense of humor in almost all of it.
Sure.
And I think that diffuses a lot of people who really pay attention. If you just look at it on the surface, yeah, that's all you're going to see. But then if you look a little deeper, there's stuff going on in the pictures that are funny. And
yeah.
Then you listen to interviews with them, and they're just a bunch of blokes who happen right. to play in a big band.
Right. Yeah, I mean, Eddie's wearing pants, for Pete's sake. Sometimes a ripped up t-shirt.
In college... I had the door, you know how they made those door size posters? It made it look like the thing was breaking through the door.
Yes. Yeah.
Totally. I had the door size poster of the Somewhere in Time Eddie in my room while I was in college.
Cool. That's very cool.
And as a BYU student, that did raise some eyebrows.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. That probably, you're probably the only one who had something like that. That's really funny.
So their first album, Iron Maiden, came out in 1980. Mm-hmm. Then 81 brought us Killers. Mm-hmm. 82 is the seminal Number of the Beast, which was covered in full by Dream Theater. Released on their official bootleg set.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Then they did, track by track? Wow.
Yeah. Okay. And then they did Peace of Mind in 83. 84 was Power Slave, the first of my trifecta. Mm-hmm. 86, Somewhere in Time, which I think is my favorite album of theirs next to Somewhere, or Seventh Son. It depends, because Somewhere in Time and Wasted Years are magical pieces of music, I think. And then mm-hmm. Seventh Son has Can I Play with Madness, The Clairvoyant, and Seventh Son, which I think are awesome pieces right. of music on their own right.
Love that song. Love yeah. Can I Play with Mass. We'll talk about that in yeah. a little bit too.
Then in 80 or 90 was No Prayer for the Dying. 92, Fear of the Dark. Then Billy Blaze came in to replace Bruce Dickinson when he took his hiatus. Mm-hmm. And he did the X Factor.
What was the purpose of the hiatus? I know he had some cancer issues later on. This was way before that.
Yeah,
though. Was this like, I'm taking a break to get my pilot's license kind of thing?
No, or? I think it was a disagreement in the band over writing and direction and things like that.
Okay.
And
okay.
so he left for those for X Factor.
Iron Maiden had a disagreement about direction? The most consistent band ever? Like.
Yeah, they actually make AC/DC look wild and uncontrolled.
Right, totally. Yeah.
Okay, so X Factor, Virtual X, 95, 98. Then Brick Dickinson comes back in 2000 for the titled Brave New World, which is Audius Huxley. They made no qualms. They based it on the title of the Audius Huxley book. Mm-hmm. 03, Dance of Death. 06, A Matter of Life and Death. 2010, The Final Frontier, and then 2015, The Book of Souls. It just dawned on...
So Huxley gets credit for Brave New World, but do they mention anything about Gene Roddenberry for The Final Frontier?
No. They might have. I don't know.
Ah, cool.
So it just dawned on me, reading this down, that we mentioned a couple episodes ago about how bands released albums every year.
Yeah.
And then they don't now. And it's amazing to watch them go through that time where they were releasing every year. And then right around 2000, they started going every few years. And there was 5 years, between their last album and the one that just came out.
Totally. Yeah. In the 80s, it was almost every year. They didn't release anything in 85, 80, or 87 or 89.
They did, though, because Live After Death came out in 85.
Right. Oh, of course. Yeah, I forget about the live albums. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So, wow. So, yeah, you know, basically start spacing them apart and then, and now taking longer breaks between albums.
Yeah.
Probably for touring and stuff. Didn't they have, there was a big issue between them and Black Sabbath, or them and Ozzy Osbourne.
Yeah, I guess, let's see. It came, what was it? Bruce Dickinson said something about, Bruce Dickinson made a comment about, reality TV shows. Okay. And Ozzy and his wife were deep in the throes of the Osbournes at the time.
Okay.
And right. So they canceled the Ozfest, a bunch of shows for Ozfest that Iron Maiden was on because of those comments. Now, here's the thing that pisses me off. I was actually supposed to go to Ozfest and see them.
Yeah.
I hadn't seen Ozzy since Metallica opened for him in the 80s, and I had never seen Iron Maiden live. So I was really excited. And then, like, a week beforehand, notice comes down from Smith Tix that the show was canceled. And so I started reading about it and found out that basically Sharon pitched a fit and canceled a bunch of shows.
Wow. So who else was part of that lineup?
I don't remember.
Did you not go just...
They canceled the show. They canceled all of it.
Oh, the actual show was canceled?
Everything was canceled. They just said... No, everything was canceled. They shut the whole thing down.
Wow. Okay. Oh, yeah. Finding a note on this online, apparently their last Ozfest performance, they were pelted with eggs. Sharon Osbourne appeared on stage to say frontman Bruce Dickinson disrespected Ozfest. It's a no from me. Wow.
So, and then they've done live albums, and I think their live albums are actually what are some of the more important pieces of work for them. That Live After Death is an album cover that I have seen ever since I've been buying records. And it's the famous blue, predominantly blue, with him coming out of the ground with the lightning striking.
Sure.
Everyone knows that album cover. Yes, I don't think anyone alive, I mean, my 11-year-old knows that album cover. It has nothing to do with the fact that I'm her dad, but she knows that. No, I'm kidding. She knows. Then they did a real dead one and a real live one, a double set in 93. They did Live at Donington. Rock in Rio in 02. They did release the BBC archives in 02. Beast Over Hammersmith came out in 02. And then they did Death on the Road in 05. And then the movie and live album kind of went with it, called Flight 666, which is where we got, I mean, it's kind of about the plane and how the plane got them from place to place, and this world tour with them in this advanced stage of their career, still filling arenas, playing places they'd never played before.
Now, is Flight 666 a live album? I know it's a collection of their biggest hits.
Yeah, it's all live. It's all recorded live.
Okay. Wow, cool.
Then they did it in vivo in 12, and then Made in England 88 was released in 2013. And then, of course, some of their clever titles were like Made in Japan, which was a live EP that came out in 81.
Sure.
So they've really, I mean, they're consistent. That's the one thing I think I can really say is they're consistent. And, you know, mid-range mixing aside, there's a reason they've got where they've gotten, and I can't knock that. But I got to tell you, it was nice that Book of Souls seemed to have a wider EQ spectrum and a little bit variety songwriting. Wrap up my listening, because
I'll have to listen to that one. I didn't make it all the way up to that one. I think I stopped in the mid 2000s, but I will listen to Book of Souls because that sounds great.
My I started with Book of Souls just because I knew the other stuff, and then I worked my way back to Book of Souls. So it was cool. it was a thing. It was an undertaking for me.
Yeah.
So shall we do the Stairway to Heaven songs?
Yeah, and this should be interesting because coming from somebody who's recently introduced to Iron Maiden versus somebody who has been listening since, you know, since their heyday.
Since 85.
It's gonna be interesting. Yeah, it's gonna be interesting to see which direction we go. I'm based. A lot of my original Iron Maiden knowledge came from cover songs. No surprise to anybody.
Oh, speaking of that, they have released a couple of things. Like I said, Dream Theater did Number of the Beast from cover to cover. I mean, from front to back.
Right.
Kerrang! Magazine released a Iron Maiden tribute album not too long ago that has Metallica on it, Dream Theater, Coheed and Cambra. I mean, just all these really important bands now. Covering Iron Maiden songs. And it's actually really good.
Right. And that's the Kerrang! Presents Made in Heaven. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Right? Yep. Mm-hmm. That is a really good one. There was one before that from a band called Food for Thought where they covered, about 18 different Iron Maiden tracks called Now That's What I Call Kin Music.
Mm-hmm.
And then just kind of the various, you know, Tribute to the Beast, Driving Miss Satan, of course, has done a fair number of great Iron Maiden covers. Metallica has covered some Maiden Hell songs, of course. So there's a great number of covers of the band out there. Now, the band themselves have never released anything, you know, like a dedicated all cover album. However, they have covered My Generation by The Who. Don't you just fade away? Talking about my generation. Don't try and dig while we all Thin Lizzy's Massacre, Led Zeppelin's Communication Breakdown, Deep Purple's Space Trucking. A lot of great covers that they just throw on to a B-side here, a B-side there, that sort of thing. So you can kind of find these as you amass your singles that you collect.
So the list of potential songs for their Stairway to Heaven song would be Number of the Beast, of course.
Right.
I think Run to the Hills would be part of it.
Yep.
I think 2 Minutes to Midnight would be one.
Yep.
And I think The Trooper. I think we got four solid
contenders.
And we could even go things like Wasted Years, Somewhere in Time. There's a lot of Rime of the Ancient Mariner. We could make this list go on and on.
Mm-hmm.
But I think as far as the big four, I think that's kind of the where we are, the conversation is.
For sure. For me, The Trooper is the one that stands out on that list. And maybe it is just because I resonate with that one, having all of the things that I love about Iron Maiden all wrapped up into one song. I think that they would do. But I think your choice, and I'll let you say your choice, but I think your choice might be the right one.
Well, actually, I'm rethinking it a little bit. I think Number of the Beast... going to be the one they played the most as far as the set list goes. That's my thing. But I'm beginning to think Run to the Hills might actually be my choice for Stairway to Heaven song.
Oh, cool. Well, that's such a great song.
Yeah, and so I'm gonna go with Run to the Hills as mine, and you go for The Trooper, and then let's take a look at the set list website and see how we did.
I pulled it up after we started talking about it, or after I said mine. Neither are we, even in the top four, even in our list, the number one song they played in concert is Iron Maiden. Song Iron Maiden, which I guess is kind of
like, it's kind of on the nose, isn't it?
Right. That, you know, they might be Giants playing, they might be Giants, or Talk Talk playing Talk Talk in concert. Second in the list is The Number of the Beast, but performed 300 times less in concert than Iron Maiden. Iron Maiden, they've performed in concert 2,131 times.
Okay, but that album, that not that song came out two full album. No, when did Run to the Hills on? That's a Number of the Beast, right?
I think so, yes.
Yeah, so we're two full albums ahead.
Before that, right. Yeah. So, yeah, and Run to the Hills, 1,347. The Trooper is fourth place with 1,436. Hallowed Be Thy Name is in third. So our four picks are among...
the top 10, maybe?
The top 10. Iron Maiden, Number of the Beast, Hallowed Be Thy Name, The Trooper, Run to the Hills, 2 Minutes to Midnight. Which one have we not...
That was it. That hit them.
Okay.
Yeah, that hit our four.
Oh, there we go. Yeah, Number of the Beast, The Trooper, Run to the Hills, and 2 Minutes to Midnight. So the top six contains our four, but
so only we were one close.
We were close. Yes. Yeah. So, 40 times touring, 40 concerts listed for 1976 alone. I mean, before Bruce Dickinson, before any of that. I mean, there's, you know.
Yeah.
And there's a set list. I love the fact that there's set list up for way back then. That is crazy.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah.
But yeah, I can go with that. I still think our choices are valid, and the set list website has validated that.
For sure. Yep.
So shall we get into picks?
Let's get to our picks. This is fun.
Far as tradition, you go ahead.
All right. So first pick was a song called The Prisoner from Number of the Beast. I'm on the run. I'm killed to eat. I'm starving now. I'm feeling dead. I'm a beast. Going all the way. I'm nature's beast. Do what I want. I'll do as I please. Run. Fight. The chord progression on this one was the thing that stood out for me. It's got some really cool chord progression. And something also that I noticed with a lot of music, I can't remember if they do it in The Prisoner, but there are times that they'll be going at one beat at one BPM and they will just stop and change over to a completely different BPM mid-song.
That's pretty frequent for them.
Yeah, it does seem to come up a lot. But you don't hear that a lot in other heavy metal
groups. and I think that there could be an argument made that they are more of a prog band, and I think it's their iconology and their history that keeps them from being labeled a prog band. But when you look at the way they structure songs and the way they technically build songs and what the lyrical topics are, it's very easy to put them in the same place as like Rush or Dream Theater or Genesis or Yes or some of these others.
For sure. Yep. Second choice, this was the song that the first ever song I remember hearing by Iron Maiden, and it was a video, seeing the video of it, basically was Run to the Hills. There was a video music program in the early 80s, or late 70s even, no, early 80s, called Teletoons. He killed our tribes, he killed our creed, he took our game for his own. Was FMTV, but when MTV formed in 81, they bought the rights to use that term from FMTV, even though they're kind of different. And it was a local public access television video program. And they used to play Run to the Hills all the time. And that song did hook me in. And even going back and listening when we were doing preparing for this show, I couldn't not include Run to the Hills, even though I think a good majority of the songs that I have on my list are in their greatest hits. This well, was one thing, I felt like is, I had to include.
That's the thing is I actually pick songs knowing where you might fall.
Yeah. Yeah. You probably expected a couple of them.
Yeah. Yeah,
sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I, if someone had said, hey, he's going to put, Can I Play With Madness on there? I would have said, yeah, of course he is.
Of course he is. Totally. Third one is 2 Minutes to Midnight. Again, not a big surprise, popular song. That was the latest or the last of the entries in here. I put it at number 3, but listened to that while I was on the bike today and was like, oh, I really like this. It's got a great biking beat, man. It is making me power my way up this hill.
There is a piano tribute, a solo piano tribute to Iron Maiden that's out there. And really? The 2 Minutes to Midnight cover on it is actually really, really good.
Hmm. I'll have to check that out for sure.
It's got a black and white cover with Eddie with piano keys, his teeth, and they're all kind of busted up. It's kind of cool.
Awesome. All right, fourth is Can I Play With Madness? Now, this for me is, it could have been a Def Leppard song. It is so glam pop and feels like it is a bending, not a breaking, but a bending of the Iron Maiden mold. And I really, really like that
song. The video for it is absolutely cheesy.
Is it?
Oh, okay.
I'll have to look at the video. But this was the song they did for... Oh, no. Bring Your Daughter to the Slaughter was the song they did for Nightmare on Elm Street 5.
Yep.
That's right. No, this is just, you know, straight ahead pop song. Really good. And then last was another one that I listened to today, Holy Smoke. This is... I talked about the other 2 Minutes to Midnight having... Or I'm sorry, The Trooper having Everything I Need in my Iron Maiden. I take that back. Holy Smoke. Every ingredient for my heavy metal pizza. You know, your screaming guitars, your harmonization, your Bruce Dickinson vocals, your drum solo, everything. And this one comes from, it was the album after, let's see, hold on a second. I had it here. It's the album after your
Fear of the Trinity. Dark? Oh, No Prayer for the Dying.
No Prayer for the Dying.
Yeah.
So it comes from the album No Prayer for the Dying. Great, another, you know, great track from them.
Now, before I start,
yeah,
I will say that it at some point in, let's see, 1998, Dream Theater did a live show. Bruce Dickinson came on stage, and they did a bunch of Iron Maiden covers with Bruce singing with Dream Theater backing.
Oh, wow. Okay.
It's on an official live bootleg. It's worth listening to because you have a band that... As technically advanced as Dream Theater playing Iron Maiden tunes with the keyboard player built into it, and then James LaBrie and Bruce Dickinson singing songs, it's really pretty good.
That's cool. Very
so cool. That's there. But my turn now for the top five.
Yes.
Wasted Years from Somewhere in Time, I think, has one of the most distinctive and interesting intros in all of Iron Maiden history.
We'll be right back.
I just love the way that song builds and falls down and starts over again and kind of progresses. It's just, it's one of my all time favorite Iron Maiden songs maybe it might be my all time favorite.
Nice.
My second choice, I actually picked because I liked the picture more than I did the song at first.
The picture that the song paints?
No, the picture that was on the single. It's a picture of Eddie playing a giant pipe organ on a rock in a storm.
Okay, I gotta pull this up.
Actually, have an action figure of him.
Oh, really?
Yeah, doing this.
Okay, why? Oh, there it is right there. Run to the Hills Live, Phantom of the Opera Live, 45. Yeah, there it is right there. Oh, that is cool.
Yeah, so I saw that, and so I thought, oh, this will be a cool song. And plus, I knew Phantom of the Opera. I was a theater kid.
Right.
And I got it, and it took me a while to get into it because it's not Bruce Dickinson on vocals. It's Paul D'Amo. Or what his name is. Paul.
It's Paul D'Anno. Yeah.
D'Anno. Yeah. He's singing on it, and it's from one of their earlier albums. It's from Iron Maiden, their first album. But after a while I grew to love it. And because it's an early one and because of, for me, the, what I see when I hear it, just because I know the picture, that's what I pay attention to. So I like it.
Cool.
The next song is one of the things that I think is so clever about what they do with their fans. They titled a song called The Reincarnation of Benjamin Brieg. They put it on the album Matter of Life and Death. When I heard it, the first thing I did was type into the internet, who is Benjamin Brieg? There was a whole website in history dedicated to this and and who he was. Then it comes out that they did it just for fun because they knew the fans were going to do it.
That they knew the fans were going to Google his name
And look up who he was and what his historical stuff was.
That's fantastic.
And it's just something they did to have their fans interact with the song.
Oh, that's really cool.
And that tells me that they're doing more than just writing songs and putting chords together. They are thinking about how people interact with their music.
That's really cool. I'm looking like a really quick paraphrasing of the biography of Benjamin Brieg, and it's really fascinating.
Yeah.
Wow.
Then my number four is the title track from Seventh Son of a Seventh Son. It is one of the longest pieces of music they've ever done. Tells the story of the prophesied seventh son of a seventh son. And it goes through all these musical motifs, and it builds and crescendos and moves on. And it's just a great piece of music. And this is one of my biggest arguments of them being a prog band is this song as its own piece of music. It
sure
feels very, very proggy to me.
Totally. Yeah, they had a lot. I was noticing that as I was going through that they did have a lot of songs that kind of broke that 7-8 minute mark. And it was a lot of prog elements, you know, little jazz elements or prog elements that they pull in there. Rime of the Ancient Mariner is another huge one, 13 minutes long. That's cool.
On Somewhere in Time, they have a song called The Long Distance Runner. And I remember I was listening to a lot of that album when I was training for my first Honolulu Marathon. And I always thought, oh, this is kind of like my theme song when I run. But it wasn't long enough because, you know, I was training for longer than that album was. But yeah, that's also a good one. But the Seventh Son is a great song.
Cool. Cool.
I grew to really, really enjoy number 5. It took some time, but I really did grow to enjoy, and that's Brave New World, from the album Brave New World. Bruce Dickinson's return, his voice was in great shape. They seemed to be kind of pushing lyrically. They seemed to be kind of pushing sonically a little bit. It kind of broke out of that mid-range hell. They mm-hmm. always seem to mix in a little bit. Live, it's a great song. Live versions of it are just fantastic.
Mm, cool.
And then as honorable mention, I'm going to throw in Empire of the Clouds from Book of Souls. It sounds very different from other things. It's dynamic. It's got some range to it. Seems to be mixed a little better. As the ship began to die, the first to guide her path, ignited at the last, the empire of the clouds, just ashes in our past, just ashes at the last.
Is that the place you'd say people should start if they're
If you know basic Iron Maiden, start at Book of Souls.
Yeah.
Get your feet wet with something new and then jump backwards.
Okay. Interesting. I'm gonna definitely do that. Fantastic. And so, of course, as always, that that playlist that we just created, that 10-song playlist, or I'm sorry, 11-song playlist, you'll find on our website, soundography.com, over there on Spotify. So make sure to check that out.
Anything before you wrap up?
I can't think of anything. This was a fun one. I really, really liked getting this introduction to Iron Maiden after, like I said, knowing a lot of their stuff via covers. 2 Minutes to Midnight, Trooper, of course, Number of the Beast, and then getting to kind of hear, all right, this is some good, solid heavy metal pizza.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing about, I think the concept of this show too is that when you have a 38 albums to dig through, you're going to miss some stuff.
For sure. Yeah.
If you're just jumping in, or you're going to get tired and quit, tap out right around Brave New World. That's kind of what we're doing, is we're helping you find ways to get started through in the catalog without tapping out.
Yep. Yeah, definitely. It definitely helps and makes it so much easier for somebody brand new to check this out. Cool. All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about next week. Episode 7 is quite a departure from the heavy metal of Iron Maiden. We're going to be looking at Weird Al Yankovic, and not just his parody songs. His parody songs will be part of the plan, of course, but primarily we're going to be focusing on his originals. And he does quite a few originals, some really, really fun and really witty originals. He's a great songwriter, which you wouldn't expect from somebody who's made a living off of creating parodies. Although, you know what? His parodies are really wittily written as well.
Yeah, they're well-crafted jokes from song to song. And as far as a songwriter goes, he pays homage to certain styles of music and then puts his own twist on the lyrics. And it really does add something to the humor when you hear it's something stylized like Devo, and it's making jokes about something else.
For sure. This is going to be a fun one. Can't wait for that. That's Weird Al Yankovic. That's going to be next week right here on Soundography. If you want to get in touch with us, email us, soundographypodcast@gmail.com. Of course, you can follow us on Twitter @TheSoundography. And for everything else, visit us on our website, our fancy pantsy website, soundography.com. Again, you'll find links to listen to the songs on Spotify, links to buy the songs from Amazon and iTunes, and of course, listings of the playlist. You'll also find on our website our Patreon. If you missed out on helping support the show via the Kickstarter, that's okay. If you feel obligated, you do want to contribute something to the show, we'd love for you to do that, and you can do that over there at patreon.com. You'll find a link on our website to get to our Patreon. That's going to do it for this edition of Soundography. Until next time, this is Brian Abbott saying thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time on Soundography.